Okay, so it is May 31st at 9:14 a.m. Bob Gitson and Patricia Hartman are interviewing Craig Geyer of Department of Biological Sciences at Auburn University.
And the general question is, how long have I been here? And I got the job in the fall of 1987. So that's when my recollections would start. So I grew up in Southern California, got the job here not knowing anything about the Southeast. So you're talking to somebody who sort of was born in 1987 relative to understanding anything about the Southeast, natural history and ecology.
So did the job is what brought you here then?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to live here since 1986, 30 years?
Absolutely not. Probably would have been one of the last states I would have listed as a place that I thought I was going to get a job.
So what would you say kept you in this area?
Pretty much the people during the job interview won me over. And sort of since 87 had my eyes open, the fact that this is a remarkably interesting area for a biologist just because it's so diverse. And the race relations weren't anything like what I'd been raised to have necessarily thought to be true. Clearly, all that stuff that I heard growing up was true, but there's a lot more that did not get sort of recorded in the lore of where I grew up.
So how did you notice that right away? Or was it something that took years to say, oh, I didn't realize this was like that? And what prompted you to have that observation?
Oh, some of it was local folks challenging, being willing to challenge me when I said things that were clearly from what I'd read, not what I'd experienced. And some of it was just sort of slowly observing sort of what it was like in places I'd grown up and what it's like here. Los Angeles is the most segregated place I've ever seen. You know, one block, you've got one ethnic group, and you cross the street, and it's another one ethnic group. And I'd just never been raised with people pointing that out as sort of a cultural reality.
Have you had many African American or minority, quote unquote, grad students that have worked in Alabama? It's kind of curious.
Not many, but Christina Romagosa comes from a Cuban background. David Laurencio's started out in my lab. He's from Costa Rica, so we've had a Latin perspective. We haven't been fortunate enough to recruit anybody of African descent, but would have loved for that to have happened. You do go to places where the old sort of plantation mentality is still present. Mm.
Have you noticed that change over the last 30 years?
Oh, depends on where you are. You can go to some places where, that rural plantation ethic is still ingrained. And so that those, there's generations that are sort of, or places where they're sort of two generations behind where you'd think they ought to be. Ichaway is this famous ecological field station, still has a very strong plantation ethic. Now, if you go to Union Springs here, that there's places there where you go up to the African Americans and they call you boss rather than your name.
Mm-hmm. So. That's what I was gonna, because there are a lot of African Americans working there.
Yeah.
It's just a very clear sort of division of.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a biologist, were you in talking to different people? Well, I'm sure you got very different perspectives. What kinds of different things did you learn from talking to an African American at HOA compared to, you know, one of the bosses? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, if you want sort of practical stuff, like where to go to find certain animals, those guys know better than anybody. The best way to learn a fauna is to grow up in it. So if you're out as a kid, sort of making your observations, that all gets recorded in your brain in ways that make those people both approachable. And if you start talking about animals that they like, they might not like them the way you do. So I do a lot of work with turtles and tortoises, and all those folks eat them. Through that process, they know where to go to find them and what their habits are and what might have happened over the years, whether they're increasing or decreasing. So they've got a lore that's pretty vital.
So you hear about people having eaten gopher tortoises in the Depression, but is that still pretty prevalent now, do you think? Or did it persist much longer than...
It's still present, but it's decreasing dramatically just because it's hard to get them. There's a bunch of them if you've got the skill to be able to pull them out of a burrow, but not many people are willing to learn that skill anymore. Just easier to go buy something off the store than to try and hook a tortoise and pull it out of its burrow.
Were they traditionally a subsistence food, or... Not just a subsistence food, just kind of a general everyday meal, meal, or
mostly on the subsistence side. But there were, you talk to some of those folks, and if they had family get-togethers, that was something they'd do, just because that's how they used to eat. And so sort of family reunions frequently would send out the local hunter to bring them all in for a meal. Mm.
How popular were tortoises to eat compared to other aquatic turtles?
Don't have really good understanding of that, but my impression is that tortoises were much harder to get. And so everybody was eating snapping turtle. Soft-shell turtles are supposedly very tasty. Those are the animals, and you can put out a hoop trap and catch those with not much effort. But to learn how to snake down a hook to the bottom of a tortoise burrow and pull an animal out that's very strong, and then do that over and over again, is a lot harder work than putting out one net and coming back a day later and getting the same 20 animals.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect it was much harder to subsist off of gophers than other kinds of turtles.
In terms of people's attitudes about the sustainability of that harvest, was it sort of catch as you can, and worry about what's going to go on down the road, or was there any informal ethic by different people I will take this much, but not more than that, or?
Yeah, it's variable. And so most folks, it's a hunter's mentality. And so they look at what other people are doing and can recognize through that the resource might be depleted. But generally, we're not introspective enough to say, hey, it's me that might be participating in this thing. I'm doing it in a sustainable way, and it's everybody else that's the problem. I've seen that sort of mindset emerge, but on the other hand, I think most of those people have also noticed that they've been eating it, the resource, for a long time, and the resource is still there. And so from that perspective, don't feel like we're necessarily at the precipice. At that level, and they might be right. It's again, not a lot of people were of were so poor that they were looking for something like a tortoise to survive to the next meal.
Mm-hmm. So, considering their declining status, yeah. People eating them probably not the greatest threat to their existence.
No.
What do you think is the greatest threat?
Oh, it's population growth, it's habitat loss, fragmentation, the big things that have been the top of the conservation list forever. And that's caused in this part of the world largely by agriculture, big fields that took huge swaths of habitat and converted it into peanut and cotton farms. That would be the biggest loss for pago gophers and gopher tortoises. Anything in the upland pine that's where we lost most of the habitat. What remains is large hunting plantation, quail hunting plantations, which is largely a very compatible activity for conservation of the sort of vertebrates I'm most interested in. And so I see that as sort of where the conservation effort for upland longleaf pine organisms on private lands, that's where you've got overlap of interests that could do some things that would be beneficial.
Have you interacted a lot with the quail plantation community? It depends, certain plantations.
Pretty like peripherally, yeah. But through Sharon. She's been into the big time version through her time at Tall Timbers, mm-hmm. Including going to the naturalist balls where these unbelievably wealthy people who've just bought these monstrous chunks of land and have maintained it in ways that keep all the organisms present. So she's dealt with those people and understands sort of their cultural history much better than I do.
So would you say they keep all of the organisms present, or?
It's a range of activity, but in general they want to hunt quail. And they have enough experience through growing up with the habitat to know what sort of old growth forest looks like. And so they're managing for both being able to come and shoot the animals and to come and just look out and see a landscape that's what they remember growing up in. And that landscape happens to be the one that the organisms we're interested or evolved in, so.
What about perceived threats to quail? That might also occur in that landscape.
Yeah, I don't know the quail literature that well. So everything I'm about to say has to be taken with that grain of salt, but I think we're still struggling to figure out why it is that this bird keeps declining everywhere. But to my mind, that all of these things, you're going to want big chunks of land managed in a way that maintains the aspect of the old growth forest, and the quail place plantations on private lands is pretty much the only place you see that. Now, the smaller and smaller those chunks of land gets, and the more heavily you manage for just the quail resource, and you chop that land up with a bunch of food plots, and you do these ring around things where you try and make oak clusters that gets to the point where the land manager is saying, well, the more of those I get, the more quail I get, then the more I think that this dynamic of what was happening there maintaining those populations start to crumble, and suddenly the quail populations go down, and you put up cameras and you find that it's snakes eating the eggs, and suddenly you blame the snakes, and you you're sort of missing the bigger issue that you had this big, broad expanse of functioning ecosystem, and the more you sort of tried to tweak it, the less it was doing what you wanted it to do.
So as far as predator control efforts, have you seen them in action at different plantations particularly?
Not directly, but indirectly enough to know that, yeah, we've stubbed our toe in attempting to control predators when we might have been better off again making sure we had what the forest had in the first place that allowed those predator and prey to equilibrate the way they sort of evolved. But at some level, again, at this point, you know, the predator communities are probably out of whack enough that there has to be some management effort done there to, especially if you're trying to keep that one bird present, that does show up as in modern landscapes as something that has to be done somehow to keep the animals there.
As a threat to gopher tortoises, do you think the same predators, or at least the mammalian predators, are much concern, or to the...
Yeah, the meso-mammal predators probably are increased, and so they are taking that resource. If you measure, if you put transmitters on baby tortoises and measure that resource, they all end up pretty much in raccoon and opossum guts. But snakes are getting them as well. But I don't think that's happened in a way that is causing a decline in tortoises. I think they're designed to live long enough that every once in a while there'll be some decrease in that mammal community, and the tortoise has a burst of recruitment, and that's sort of how they've evolved to get through that process to begin with. Nobody's ever tested this, but there's an idea in the tortoise community that rabies comes through and wipes out all the raccoons and opossums, and there's a short burst of time when you get a whole bunch of tortoise that recruit into the population, and that's sort of how they managed to do that for millions of years.
Have you noticed changes in that mesocarnivore community since you got here? Or?
I have not. The only one I've noticed is armadillos. They had just invaded Lee County when I got the job. And are clearly much more abundant now than they were when I first got here. But that's a animal that, if you go back to the Pleistocene, it used to be here, so it's one that got pushed back for whatever reason and now has returned. So I'm not personally concerned with that one, as long as, again, we can find big chunks of land to that might function the way those landscapes used to function ecologically.
Are there some invasive species that you think would be a particular threat to the longleaf pine ecosystem?
Kogon grass is one that comes to mind. Fire ants is one that I've got to mention just because I replaced Bob Mount, and you guys should interview him because he's got the longer term perspective. He grew up in this part of the world and can give you the sort of a deeper historical perspective. And he's pushed that, and I trust his judgment on that. I think he's right. I think he oversells it, but I think there are some instances where that organism came up and disrupted certain of the species, not to the point where it caused the entire forest structure to disintegrate, but certainly impacted certain species.
Has the fire ant distribution shape and density, have you noticed any systematic change since you came, or was it already kind of at a, they were everywhere when you got here?
Were everywhere when I got here. Yeah. I've heard people say they're declining, but that's not my, not something I picked up in sort of just my wanderings.
People will talk about, at least from Autotel Timbers, that without soil disturbance, that kind of old growth pine that's burned frequently, there's tracks without fire ants, is the reports I've heard. Do you have any feeling that a healthy longleaf pine community is a fire ant free community?
I'd have to see that to believe it, but on the other hand, I think that's generally true of these invasive species. They're coming in on the edges and finding it difficult to penetrate into the center of a group of organisms that sort of co-evolved. But as soon as you create a patch where the edge is greater than the core, then that's when, and we've got a whole lot of that where you still have things like tortoises present. But they're being assaulted by Kogon grass coming in, and privet, and Japanese climbing fern, all these things that would suddenly choke things off from the edges. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely see that, but I want to believe that the heart of the Wade tract was immune to fire ants, but if I remember right, I think they are on the Wade tract.
And where is that located?
Wade Tract is Thomas County, South Georgia. It's the prettiest tract of longleaf that I know of. And it is old growth in the sense that the trees have never been cut. And the soil's never been plowed. And so it's got ground cover that's intact and surrounded by a nice plantation. But it's right out on the outside of skirts of Thomasville, Georgia, so it's all these problems of encroachment from the edges. That place is going to have to deal with that.
What were your early projects when you started here? Like what
first project was gopher tortoises,
yeah,
in Mississippi. The DeSoto National Forest has a seed orchard where they grew the longleaf pine that produced the seed cones that then reforested pretty much the southeast. And they had to redo their seed orchard, and there were tortoises on it. And that's in the part where they had been listed under the Endangered Species Act. So my first grant was to go over there.
Mm-hmm.
We had the big government grant coming in here from Alabama trying to tell us how to run our... Yep.
Did you get a lot of crap from people about that, or resentment?
We were crossing state boundaries, and it was a place where you had Forest Service was present there, Fish and Wildlife Service was present there. Part of it's run by the Army. So you had all these agencies that are also tend to be territorial. And so it was, certainly got my lab off the ground, but it was interesting from that perspective that you're trying to appease many masters.
So were you getting pushback from the community as well, or was it more agency-oriented, both?
The community, they reacted the same way pretty much everywhere we've gone. They recognize you're from outside, but they're also interested in you. A lot of those places don't have a lot of outsiders, so they want to come talk to you. The first thing they want to do is sort of challenge you. If you're working with tortoises, everywhere we've ever gone, the first thing they said, "Oh yeah, well I eat them. Can you tell me what your recipe is for them?" But they're just basically trying to prod you to see sort of what your mindset is, not necessarily that they're telling you sort of get out of my backyard.
So are there particular things aside from their distribution or where you might want to go look for them? Are there other things that surprised you that you've learned from community members that aren't affiliated with any research?
Yeah, pretty much. Everywhere we've worked, we've also bumped into someone that the community knows of that's sort of the tree hugger. Somebody generally who's grown up in that area, not necessarily well educated, but very knowledgeable about the area. And there's always been somebody that the community would say, hey, go talk to this person. Because that's the person who pulls gopher tortoises off of roads and puts them in their backyard, for example. We've always bumped into somebody in the local community who's doing that because they don't want all their animals to necessarily go in a pot or cross the roads and get squished. And so you get a diverse culture in every community. So there's always that person. And that's generally the... the people that we grew up at being as biologists.
If we were to drive it, go stop in Hertzboro or one of those, you know, get out and start asking, hey, we're interested in tortoises and pocket gophers and wondering if there's anyone in anything.
There'll be somebody that the community would eventually say, hey, you need to go talk to this person.
So you mentioned that also you get a sort of a testing of people asking about, what's your favorite recipe?
Yeah.
Do you hear a lot about stories of people saying, oh yeah, I saw a snake the other day and I killed it, or rattlesnake roundups, those kinds of things? That what kind of stories do you hear about that?
The snake stories are pretty also the same. Again, these are folks who growing up with them and have to deal with the fact that they're in their yard all the time. And most of those folks just take the practical view of, I'm going to whack its head off because it's going to get my dog or my kids or my grandkids or whatever. So, and that's pervasive everywhere you go. But on the other hand, you also, that's those same communities. If you're in them long enough and start talking about them, you sense that there's a part of their culture that doesn't necessarily want to wipe them out. So they all like telling stories of coming out of a tree stand and there was that rattlesnake sitting right there and scared the crap out of me. But they write songs about that stuff and have lore that they tell around the campfire. So it's not that they necessarily want to get rid of it. It's just they grew up in it with a different mindset of what that resource is all about.
So have you heard any stories about what the lore associated with those kind of critters?
Yeah, in the case of venomous snakes, the lore is pretty much all bad. And so it's, beds of moccasins. Everybody talks about that. And not just that they've heard about it. They know somebody who fell down in one and could have been killed. And they all were coming after me. And that's why I had to shoot it to save my life. And if you try and tell them that's a place where you were looking at water snakes, that you never find water moccasins that thick, that's the point where you lose them, because they're so convinced that the lore is right that you're not going to educate them that it was actually this harmless snake, because they look at that harmless snake and know that that's a moccasin too. So you do bump into the edge of being able to switch them to your mindset, but at some level, I don't necessarily think that they're thinking, let's completely get rid of the resource, with the possible exception of the venomous snakes. That one is a mindset where many people are would be just as soon glad that they were gone.
So, to what extent is the learning, making a big generalization, two-way? I mean, you learn a lot from talking to them, and is there, as you talk to people in a particular community more and more, are they eager to learn what you know as a world herb expert? Or, I know it's...
Yeah, they're always curious. But it's a double-edged sword. So the understanding the natural history, they're into that. But you do reach a point where, again, your information and their information eventually may not mesh. And so you bump into a wall where you frequently can't get over. But they're generally willing to sit and listen. I've never been to a place where they weren't curious about what we were learning. And certainly in the case of repatriating indigo snakes, they love that snake. That's the easiest conservation cell we've ever had, because they all heard the lore growing up, even though they never saw, you know, there's a generation of people that have never seen that snake, but they all know that, those indigos eat rattlesnakes, and we do have kind of a lot of copperheads, and if you're telling me that this snake might take care of that, I'm all for it. And the coolest story we had from that experience was some hunter coming out of his hunting stand, and he stepped right next to a big indigo, and it scared the crap out of him, but he didn't shoot it, and went right to the little mom and pop store in the center of Kaneka, where everybody sits around and tells their stories, and told that story. And when we heard it, we were pleased as punch, because that's a success story. If the hunters are saying, I'm not going to shoot that snake because it's sort of enhancing my experience out here, getting rid of something I'd just as soon not be present. Copperheads probably are more abundant than they ever were, just because we've wiped out king snakes and indigo snakes that used to eat them.
And so that was after the reintroduction?
Yeah. Yeah, I bumped into one of our big snakes, and but again, knew about the project and clearly had bought in, because before that, I'm certain a big black snake would have been just shot, unless they knew it was part of this effort to put in this predator that's going to help do all these things.
Have there been some management efforts that have been more controversial or hard to get pushed through?
Yeah, the first tortoise project in the Kaneko was associated with Nelly Pond, one of the prettiest sinkhole ponds in the Kaneko. And this is an environment that never had fish in it that was worth fishing. Because the water levels rise and fall so dramatically that none of the sunfish radiation could maintain populations in there. But it would maintain water so that if you kept putting the fish back in, then you could create a resource. It was a pond that gopher frogs bred in. The goal from the fish and wildlife perspective was to enhance the tortoise population so they could keep the gopher frogs, because this is one of their two best remaining gopher frog populations. And they put up signs saying to the locals, yeah, we're restoring this resource. And we had a big community meeting to try and communicate with the fishing community in there. And they pretty much told us, well, we understand what you're doing, but we're not giving up that pond.
Yeah.
They were open-minded enough to say, hey, but let's brainstorm. We'll help you pay to dig ponds for your gopher frogs. But they were up front and said, you know, we like fishing there. We've been doing it forever, and we're just going to keep putting fish back in there. And sure enough, that's what they did. Eventually they ceded that pond to us. So in the bitter end, we got what we wanted. But it was interesting to go through that tension where, again, they were set in their ways, we were clearly set in our ways, and didn't necessarily come up with the right solution, but time finally found one.
So, yeah, gopher frogs do seem like they would be a harder sell.
Yep.
Than indigo snakes, if you can say, oh, yeah, they
what good are
snakes.
They?
So,
if we lost them, what big loss would it be?
Do you have sort of a response to why is biodiversity important?
Yeah, but and to that community, I generally appeal to their field lore, field ethic, because when they go out in nature, they like to hear barred owls. If the barred owl was gone, it wouldn't change their resource that they're looking to hunt necessarily, but they like to go out on a night and hear that, and they all learn to give the hoot owl call and call back to it. And in the case of frogs, I think it's the same thing. If you talk about a hunting experience where suddenly there's no frogs calling in the background, mm-hmm. I think you can get to them that way. They wouldn't want to lose that resource completely.
When did you start working or spending time in the Kaneka?
That was,
you got here?
That was the second project.
Yeah.
Started working in Mississippi, and then the Kaneka had a challenge cost share program that may still be going. I don't know. That essentially, for small sums of money, if I could match what they had, then they'd throw in. That's how the gopher frog or gopher tortoise project got started around Nelly Pond.
Mm-hmm.
We converted that into, we tried to set up an experiment where we had three sites where they were going to thin and burn and try and manage for tortoises. And we had three sites where they were going to just do regular management, which was very long rotation burnings. They weren't going to thin. So we had six sites where we, for about a 3-year period, compared to what happened with those management practices, but just too short a time frame. I was young and naive at that time. Thought we'd see something immediately, and learn that you'd have to keep that going for 10, 20 years to really see the benefit that I'm certain would eventually show up for tortoises and gopher frogs, but that's a long time frame to see the vertebrate response that you want to see.
What was the condition of the Kaneka in general then? Was there much open pine, well burned, or was it?
No. It was forested, but they were trying to burn, but the burn cycles was all winter burn. And so it was, and then generally on a 3 to 5 year, but that generally means 5 to 7 year burn rotation, which is just too long to keep the shrub layer out. So it was shrubby, dense, dark. All the tortoises were moved to the edge, generally road edges where they got the most open habitat you could get, except for the deep sandy soils. And those, the pine growth was so slow that things looked kind of okay there. They all had pocket gophers. Mm-hmm. Still present when we first started working there. And we had those six tortoise sites, and if my recollection is that every one of them had pocket gophers on them, and not a one of them has it today.
Would you say those were the hot spots for pocket gophers in the Kaneka, or were they beyond?
Yeah, tortoises and pocket gophers, to my mind, were intimately tied, just because that soil was so deep that nothing could grow on it. And so it remained sort of open, less shrubby, more of understory vegetation. And so the tortoises were distributed in a more natural way than sort of being right along the road edges. And again, they all had pocket gophers on them.
Sometime could we have you show you a map and have you map where those, or a publication that we can... Were they, do you think, would you have considered the pocket gopher populations on those sites to be kind of a viable populations if you had to guess?
I mean, I did at the time. But
were there pretty high density of them as far as different than mine? Yeah.
In my mind, I'm remembering what I saw there, and there were mounds everywhere, and they were fresh, and seemed to be changing. And I remember saying, "Man, I'm too hamstrung trying to keep track of the tortoise burrows, but I should be trying to follow these things." And harvester ants is the other one. I wish I'd marked when I first started there. Wasn't particularly concerned about, but I. Since then, the people in Mississippi are saying, "Well, we've lost essentially all of our harvester ant mounds," and I can still find them on the Kaneka. But I think they're right. I don't think they're as abundant. I don't have any data to back that up. But I think the time is now to start marking those just to see what is happening. But when I first got there, I said, "Nah, pocket gophers. They look like." They're going to be fine, and then watched them all disappear.
So was it just one of those things where over time, one day you kind of said, "I think they're declining," and
And this is where Bob Mount, I'd sit and talk with him because he did that survey in the 80s, and his was taking classes starting in the early 70s. So he could tell you whether my mindset was naive or whether his mind has a longer time frame over which they decline. But
when do you last remember them being common, approximately? Was like general time
90s.
Did the habitat change much?
And so again, my working hypothesis is that it was such a small patch that it blinked out, and there's just no way for them to get back. That if you put them back in there, my gut level intuition says, yeah, they'd probably do well. But given that they blinked out, the question is, how big does that patch need to be to make sure that you don't have them flourish for a decade? And then, or it might be the case that is the management strategy. You get a bunch of patches going, and every once in a while you throw in some new individuals to make sure that it doesn't just blink out. But I'd like to see the Kaneka think more broadly and just get a big chunk where they're saying we're going to have a viable tortoise population, and where it's going to be a viable pocket gopher population, and maybe two or three of those, and whatever you need to do on the rest of the forest, go ahead and manage that in whatever way you need to. But at least you can say there's a patch, and it's going to have indigo snakes and gophers and pocket gophers and RCWs and any of these other things we have on our list.
Do you have any reason to think they're a lot more widespread 100 years ago in the Kaneka, or was it these were almost remnant populations in the best habitat? Or talk to Bob Mount too?
I talked to Mount, but my impression is they were more widespread.
Yeah.
They're on. First, you're certain they're on the Wade Tract, and that's all Orangeburg soils, which is not the Cadillac class of tortoisile. It's the next one down. And so my recollection of Kaneka was not necessarily that you would drive everywhere and see them everywhere. I think on these less suitable soils that they necessarily remember pocket gophers being everywhere there, but certainly on the troop, because anywhere you had that deep troop, and that's a huge chunk of Kanaka. They were there and seemingly doing well.
And I can follow up with you another time to kind of maybe draw spots on a map and ask more about that. So.
And when the Forest Service, when we first started that project, they took me to places that they knew there were lots of tortoises. And I think they, in their mind's eye, sort of knew the hot spots and knew that the rest of it was not particularly abundant. And so that probably shaped my thinking. And that since then we've done line transect survey throughout all of Kanaka. And there's some nice looking habitat, but very low tortoise densities. And I think the same things happened to them that happened with the tortoises or with the pocket gophers. They sort of blinked out and they don't necessarily repopulate easily. But you can quite easily enhance that.
I could follow up either at asking, well, on the topic of pocket gophers, are there other lands in Alabama you've been on that either you remember there being a lot of pocket gophers historically in your time, or that looked good and you would have expected them to be there, but you didn't see any? Is there other places that come to mind?
The one place I remember is federal lands around Eufaula. They've got some upland there.
Refuge land or not?
Yeah, it's. And I remember him being there enough, and they would have to have been there enough to have that have sunk into memory. But the other person I talked to, if you haven't, is Mark Bailey, because I relied on him almost exclusively when I first got here, because I didn't know anything, and he was the one I turned to. And I know he's got lots of experience wandering around and can say, oh yeah, I used to be here. But there, the Whaley Tract and Kanaka were the spots I remember you'd walk and say, oh man, look at all this.
But that is National Refuge, Wildlife Refuge now, or not just Wildlife Refuge, that you follow?
Yeah, it's, okay. There's some of it that's Wildlife Refuge.
Were there tortoises there?
They are, but at very low density, and they kind of don't want anybody to know they're there. There used to be a gopher frog population there that might still be there for all we really know, but I think that spot sort of had enough of, it was big enough and had enough old growth remnants that a lot of these rare things were present and blinked out.
Have you spent any time on Fort Rucker or been able to?
None.
Yeah.
I've heard lots of stories of people that have been on there, but all the things I picked up about there is that the military establishment there has been pretty closed-minded about outside influence. Didn't really seek much. Some of the Auburn wildlife folks are there on part of their staff, so there is an inn. But they all seem to develop this culture of saying, well, we'll just manage things internally. We don't want outside eyes telling us what to do.
It's one other pocket gopher related question. I mean, certainly they have the reputation. I mean, there's information out there about how to kill, pocket gophers in general. I mean, have you encountered many croplands, golf courses, anything like that, stories where they were, have you encountered many people who thought of them as a pest and know places where they became a pest within?
Yeah. The forest industry.
Yeah.
Viewed them as a pest to eliminate. And I think that certainly on private lands that took what was probably a much more interconnected set of populations and cut them up into things that could, there's no chance for rescue effect. And they were convinced that the animals were eating the seedlings, and the only way you were going to get recruitment is to get rid of the pocket gophers. But I think there's a study at Itchway where they showed that seedling establishment on the mounds of the pocket gophers enhanced seedling development.
Yeah.
And they eat some of them, but the ones that were left were actually enhanced, and that there might be this interesting dynamic there that eliminating the pocket gophers actually increased the effort that you had to put into the remaining seedlings that weren't necessarily going to grow quite the way you want them to had they had the gopher mounds to grow on. The real gopher mounds, not the...
Yeah. Too many gophers.
Exactly.
So you think that was in forestry specifically more than just agriculture in general?
Yeah. The lower, as I understood it in forestry, when I got here, was still one of, you got to get rid of the pocket gophers if you want a functioning forest.
Yeah, because I see on a lot of the Extension Service publications still, especially more out west than here, but here's how you need to get rid of your pocket gophers, here's how you
need it.
So one thing that I just think is interesting, and it's kind of now changing topic, but the different names that people, and sort of these mismatched names of different species, like people calling other names that people might call pocket gophers, or I don't know, what do you have thoughts on why those different names have come about, common names or
something? Yeah, it's just, this part of the world sort of developed slowly, and it's basically an area where you got these little enclaves. And so if you're into folklore, certainly every mountain you go over, suddenly you get a different take on a particular tale. And it's just like gene flow between populations and conservation. Sometimes it's enough that that's the exact same story, but sometimes sort of the transmission rate is slow enough that you get a slightly different variant. And so you get all sorts of really interesting names that emerged because of that. Mount's the guy to talk to because he grew up when it was still sort of all those enclaves,
right,
and made a point of trying to learn all the common names. But for pocket gophers, most of the local ones would call it sandy mounder, is what they were trying to say, but it eventually slurred into salamander.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they were comfortable calling them that.
Gopher seems to pop up in a lot of species. So,
yeah.
So as far as what Bob Mounts, one person that you keep mentioning, as far as conservation efforts and people who laid the groundwork for habitat restoration in this area.
In this area. Wow. So, since I've been here, the Forever Wild legislation was the most remarkable conservation event. And it's been such a bestseller that even when we were worried, it was set up so that it expired after a certain number of years, I forget, 10 or 15, and so it had to be re-upped, and there was a concern that it wasn't going to be re-upped, but if I remember right, it was like smashingly, overwhelmingly supported by the people.
So here, who spearheaded that?
That I don't really know the ins and outs of. So it's a political level thing. So I suspect Nature Conservancy was involved. The Sierra Club, I'm sure, was in it. And it's something that's gone from state to state. And so we joined, but the folks in the state who pushed that were all sort of university conservation oriented people and groups like Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy. The Bankhead National Forest has a community of people that have been conservation oriented forever. They're sort of a new loose-knit group, but they sort of spearheaded people in that part of the world saying, yeah, let's vote this through. And so that's the single biggest conservation event that I've seen. And now suddenly you've got a board of people that represent the various regions, and there was suddenly a mechanism at the state level of nominating tracts of land and trying to decide, given our limited resources, which ones we should get now, which ones we should keep on a back burner, that kind of thing. But before that, I talked to Mal, but I suspect it was all just individuals
mm-hmm.
having the political clout or the persistence to push something through.
What about researchers who might have, like, prior to you?
George Folkert's huge name. The folks in Birmingham, some of the smaller colleges have had people who've had big influence. So Larry Davenport's a name that keeps coming up. I've never actually met him, but I think he's at Birmingham Southern or Samford, one of the two. But he's had an influence in that. I know his students, if they come here, all are very knowledgeable about sort of local lore. And the Birmingham area has a bunch of sort of city parks, and the McWayne Center now used to be the Red Mountain Museum. They've sort of just, as a group, managed to do things that, from my perspective, are really interesting. Set aside lands, set up a conservation ethic, all those kinds of things we'd like to do.
What are you proudest of in terms of your impact on Alabama Southeast?
Oh.
Conservation, science, whatever.
Certainly putting out students that sort of stayed home and are doing nuts and bolts kinds of issues. So we just had the Southeast Park meetings, Partners in Amphibian Reptile Conservation, and we took a group picture of all the people that had traced their roots to Auburn. And it was a monstrously large group. Some of that was because it was in Alabama, and so we were all here. But I'm pretty sure that no other state could have matched an assemblage that large. And these are all people that are sort of where the rubber meets the road. They're in state-level government things trying to do herp-related non-gain. So that was kind of cool. The fact that our work here, the research on gopher tortoises, is now being used across all the states to make decisions on what we're going to do, that that's something I point to say we might have made an impact there.
So am I right in thinking today is you're retiring now?
This is the last official day.
Last day?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the end of the day.
Although the university saw the fact that since I'm 9 months, my last official payday was in the middle of May. And they used that as a mechanism to say, yeah, pull them off the books.
Okay.
Because if my students came to get some paperwork signed, according to the university, no, you can't sign for that anymore. You'll have to find somebody else.
Right. Yes. Okay. Do you think you're going to continue to work on this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If you had unlimited funding, if someone said, here's a bunch of money, is there something that you know off the top of your head that you would want to do?
That, of course, would change day to day, depending on what you knew and what was sort of at the top of your mind. But if there were unlimited funds, then the place to put those unlimited funds is going to be biased by the fact that I did mostly work on tortoises for this part of the world. So I'd be looking at South Alabama. And there is this GCPEP where the Blackwater River State Forest in Florida and Kaneka National Forest here and Geneva State Forest in Alabama and Eglin Air Force Base. They're all talking to each other saying, man, let's have all our management efforts sort of be geared to reach common goals. And I see that as for the longleaf pine, that's where we're going to be able to keep a place where there might be black bears. If you thought broadly enough, there might be Florida panthers brought back into a landscape. So I'd probably put it there. If you had $12 million, there's a piece of land that goes from Alabama into Florida that's spectacular, and it's available to be purchased today.
Wow.
We buy it right now, tomorrow, if you were saying there was unlimited funds.
Right, yeah.
But that conceivably could be a private part of all this public holding that would, I think, could be managed in a way where all those things, all the animals that I'd like to see maintained, could be maintained.
Yeah.
And people could still be generating money. You could still be harvesting timber. You wouldn't be maximizing your profits, but you'd be making money. I think those were all achievable goals.
Are you optimistic about where you see Alabama wildlife, Southern Alabama wildlife, open pine wildlife heading over the next 100 years?
Oh.
Not.
Wow. Oh. What's happening in the tortoise world gives me the greatest hope, because all the states are talking to each other, they're all doing the same things, and they are trying to integrate across landscapes. But in general, the problems are pretty grave. And I do think conceptually you could potentially get Florida panthers across that GCPEP landscape, but you'd probably have to be bringing in genetic stock every once in a while to maintain that. But that's feasible biologically. But at that level, you got to talk to the local folks and get them to buy in the fact that their dogs and cats are going to get eaten. And that at that level, that may be too tough. So, marginally optimistic. But we got to get moving on some of this stuff. You know, I've pretty stunned that again all of those plots where I saw, every one of them had pocket gophers, and they're all gone. And again, I know how. At one point, I was seriously considering trying to do that as a repatriation project because Mark Bailey and I made that report to the state, and I didn't want that to be a report that just sat on the shelf. I wanted to actually do something. Mm-hmm. So we did the indigos. The next one would have been pocket gophers, but I know how tough it is to take those things out.
Yeah.
And we had the place where we could have done it, but there just wasn't enough energy to do that and indigos and
yeah.
something else. So it's got to be a bunch of other folks who all say, yeah, let's dovetail here in this place and make it all happen.
So that's a report that you wrote for the state?
Yeah. It's the state wildlife grants is another, that's a key resource.
Mm-hmm.
And what they wrote, they brought sizable chunks of money to my lab, certainly helped keep it running on the gopher tortoises and the indigo snake stuff. Not sizable by the standards of my colleagues in biological sciences. We've gone heavily genomics oriented. They're in the hundreds of thousands to million-dollar grants, but to run my lab, $30,000-$40,000 per year, that goes a long way. So, and this program was set up initially where they took the reports and they didn't just put them in a folder somewhere in Montgomery. They made PDFs, put them out on the web, so all that stuff is freely available. I hope they keep that process open. Because most of those reports are pretty nice, and they all pretty much say, hey, here's what the state needs to be doing. And so there's something on record to go back to and look to see what progress we might be making. But we thought we laid it out there to say flatwood salamanders, like you could chance they could be repatriated to Kaneka. Pocket gophers were on there. Southern hognose snakes, they've disappeared. Nobody really understands why. Might be fire ants. It's a ground nester, puts eggs on the ground. But on the other hand, eastern hognose are still there. They lay their eggs in the same place. Why did that one species disappear and not the other ones? You go down to Eglin, they're Southern hognose are still there. They've got fire ants. How do we get that animal back? Seems like we could repatriate it.
More questions?
Oh, I think the high quality areas on the Kaneka that had pocket gophers, did they have Southern hognose snakes, and were there a lot of fox squirrel? What were the other open kind of
fox snakes? Squirrels are there, but I don't understand them.
Yeah.
And that's one that I've heard people say used to be much more abundant. And Southern hognose, since I got here, have nobody's ever brought one in alive. One showed a really nice specimen, showed up in my lab freezer with no data. So I have no idea where it came from, but it was a big, nice adult. But nobody's ever brought one in since I came to Auburn. Mount did a survey in the Kaneka, and I think he got one in the 80s. So by then, and that's when he started saying, man, all these things are disappearing. King snakes were still present there, but he was saying, I'm not seeing these as abundantly as I used to, and here's all these fire ants. That's where he started piecing that together. So hognose were gone by the time I got there. Pachycophorus again, still there, seemingly abundant to my eye, but not necessarily, they certainly weren't abundant across the entire landscape.
Eastern Diamondbacks changed much in Creek. That's about my last specific question.
In my eye, no. Slow decline. Bruce Means did that project where he looked at the records of the biggest snake and the number of snakes that came into the rodeo. Mm-hmm. And it's, 15, maybe 20 years worth of data, and it shows a clear statistical decline. Mm-hmm. But that animal's fecundity is pretty high, so I don't think that was necessarily indicating that we were wiping out the population. We're just changing its demography, mm-hmm. is my interpretation. And so rather than having big old adults in the population, it's still, we've farm them out. We never let them grow that big. Mm. But they can continue to maintain a viable population with smaller individuals producing a whole bunch of kids. Because they have live birth and don't have any of the fire ant dilemmas at that level. Mm. Big kids, they grow fast. Mm. We put our drift fences, everywhere we put out a drift fence, we get Eastern Diamondback. Everywhere we put out a drift fence, we get pine snakes, even though I can't find them when I just wander around, but they're at some, and we see road kills persistently in Conecuh, so I think that animal has achieved some semblance of some dynamic where they're probably less abundant than they used to be, but they don't strike me as something that's necessarily about to blink out. But it's on the list of, we continually keep it on the state list because everybody says, yeah, we don't see as many as we used to.
I have one.
Okay, so your big killer last question.
I have one kind of horrible question, which is, so you talked about in, you know, working with a specific group of people or community members,
yeah.
how you can say, here's why you should care about this.
Yeah.
But in a broad sense, to you, why is biodiversity important?
Oh, man.
I figure this is a kind of question that you might ask someone in their dissertation.
So the psychological answer is, I never outgrew third grade. When you hit that stage, and you know, dinosaurs and lizards and frogs, that's just an innate fascination. Psychologically, that has to be what drives my becoming a biologist. And there's certainly, I can recruit students that all pretty much had the same experience. They're in it because they don't want to go through life without finding out where these things live, what they're doing. We learn beyond that to tell stories about, you know, webs, and you pull one thing out of the web and the web structure falls apart, and I think there's enough biology to suggest that that's true as well. Part of what we're doing is climate change is real, and that's a sort of one thing at a time, and suddenly, gee, the dynamic is pretty dramatic, to where, you know, we should have, that's where I get very pessimistic, because I think we've crashed that boat. had warning signs, needed to start turning the boat, and it takes forever to turn the boat, and we still need to do something now, but that's a scary scenario in my opinion.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you don't have any other questions, no?
Yeah.
It's been a wonderful first interview.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Wide-ranging.
Yes.
Happy to do it.
Wide-ranging, and yeah, thank you very much.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, thank you.